Ethan, what do you make of yesterday's vote?
I think that, one, it's hilarious because AOC comes out with this absolutely absurd plan for saving the planet and pretty much saving humanity. And she doesn't even want it to go towards a vote whatsoever because I feel like she knows that it's not a good plan. And then, well, lo and behold, it fell through.
It did. I kind of love the fact that all of these Democratic leaders were willing to publicly in front of cameras say that they are all about the Green New Deal. But when it comes down to brass tacks and what will you actually vote for, none of them were willing to affirm it.
Yeah, I think the idea of making legislation and then pushing it for a vote without a purpose of actually coming to a truthful conclusion, that just bothers me somehow, because AOC makes a plan and then pushes against having it being voted on because this deal is meant to bring her publicity and it's not actually meant to solve any problems. And this kind of proves that she knows that.
Totally. I mean, it's this weird thing where it's all well and good as long as she's able to give speeches about the environment. But when it comes down to something real and actual debating it on the floor of the Congress and the Senate, or in this case, the Senate, and then bring it to a vote, suddenly she doesn't want the debate. She'd rather be in front of the cameras or rather in front of her own camera while slicing potatoes, threatening us all with global annihilation.
Yeah, she's definitely one to be very active on media. It seems like she's always going live on Instagram, and she's not doing anything political in particular. She's either walking home from work or making dinner or something. Like, it's always just some random thing.
Well, I don't know if you've seen him, but there's another Democratic candidate for president. Not that AOC is one of those, but the guy's name is Beto O'Rourke. Have you heard of this guy?
No, I haven't. Does he do something similar?
Something like that. He's from Texas, and I was reading an article about him yesterday in the Washington Post, and he part of he and his wife's rise to political fame was that they would put major parts of their life on Facebook Live and draw in thousands, millions of Americans to like watch their life. He was one of the first politicians to really kind of capture that whole, ooh, yeah, I can show you how I live, and that way you'll vote for me as a normal person.
Well, I can see how that works because it makes people look more human, I guess you could say. So
it does. I read through about a 5-minute article, and I now know a lot about the architecture of his house, but I still don't know what any of his political positions are, which I found mildly disturbing. I don't want to be able to divorce those from each other too strongly.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into it. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. My name is Josh Herring. I'm a humanities instructor and debate coach at Thales Academy in Rollsville, North Carolina. I'm joined today by Ethan Delves. Ethan, introduce yourself to our audience.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ethan Delves. I absolutely love debate, and I've been doing it for about 4 years now. And we bring What's the Res to you in order to help give everyone a better understanding of debate and answer some of the most controversial questions within debate from our own perspective and try to provide some insight into how the game actually works.
Excellent. Well, today is another bonus episode. Ethan and I are both on our spring break. We're at a year-round school where I teach and Ethan's a student. And because of that, we have this 3-week track out, as we call them, and we're testing out a new method where we're recording without actually being physically present together. In order to test this out, I thought we could talk about an article that was published in the Atlantic Journal Constitution on March 19th by Maureen Downey. The article is entitled, "Rather Than Denounce Controversial Ideas and Speakers on Campus, Debate Them." And the article really has two parts. Maureen Downey is the reporter for the Atlantic Journal Constitution. She writes an introduction to the article, and then two other folks take over, one named Ian Kingsbury and the other Robert Maranto. And they're two academics who have written this sort of call to action to really bring debate back as a major piece of academic endeavors. And so it's kind of a fascinating piece. So let's get into it. Ethan,
let's do it.
What'd you make of this article? What stood out to you?
So, I think like the main thing that stood out to me was how this article addresses some sort of ignorance. You know what I mean? Because what's absolutely appalling to me is how people aren't willing to listen, and especially when there's ideas in contrast to their own. Because my first reaction to that, especially as a debater, is like, why would you not listen to ideas that are opposed to your own? Because once those ideas are out, you have every opportunity to attack them if you want to, or to even change your own opinion as you go along and then come closer to truth. But it seems like in today's society, everyone is so opposed to that idea, and it's actually promoted to just block other ideas out without even giving it an ear. And then nobody gets smarter that way. And I don't really understand that. Like, it doesn't make sense.
So it seems that this whole denouncing idea really goes against what I at least would assume has something to do with the very purpose of education, with encountering new ideas and engaging them.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, the only reason I can see for it is that it's easier to win out when you don't even fight your enemy. And it's easier to look like you're winning. But I can guarantee that if you block out other ideas, whatever ideology you follow, whatever idea you have, like, it's not as strong as it could be. Especially if you put your own ideas against someone else's.
So that whole debate process is really going to force people to strengthen their ideas because have to push back against the feedback they get.
Right, exactly.
Well, let's before we get to anything particular from the article, let's be a little bit controversial on our show. What issues strike you as controversial in today's political climate?
Climate change is definitely one of them. So that's actually one of the biggest ones, and pretty much the heart of the Green New Deal, although it does skip around in some places and bring in a lot of irrelevant things. Let's see, healthcare is another huge issue that I hear a lot about, especially recently on the news. Those are really the main two for me that I read about a lot. I see tons of climate change, tons of healthcare, and open borders is another one that I read a lot about. That's a pretty interesting one as well, because there's some people that are saying like more restrictions or less restrictions, and some people just say all out open borders, which I think is insane. I think that's dangerous. But.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, those issues get heated really fast. And I think three that I'd toss in the mix, those three are all kind of are all particular policy oriented controversial issues. There's a lot that have a lot more to do with simply the way people live. Questions I'm thinking of, I have a lot of friends who have they've wrestled through questions of sexual identity and orientation, and they find that to just be a very those are troubling waters to go through, and there's a lot of ways that people get upset one way or the other in that whole arena. Recently, in the last 6 months, abortion issues have been on the national stage again, with events in Virginia and New York, and the question of just how late will an abortions be done. There's at least one other one. In the past week, President Trump he affirmed the whole idea of free speech on college campuses. Which you would not think would need to be affirmed. You would think that our college campuses are bastions of free speech. After all, every student at a college campus either has parental consent to be in that environment or is of legal adult age, and they're there to be shaped and be formed through different ideas and through the clash of those different ideas. But that's not become the case. A lot of our college campuses are trying to do something different, as we'll get into. So even the very idea of free speech has become problematic in a way.
Yeah, it really has. And the college campus thing surprises me in particular, because I would agree that the purpose of education, or at least one of the purposes, is to strengthen your ideas by hearing the opposing side. Like, it's not only just an idea strengthener, it's like a character strengthener. Like, you have the ability to listen to people. And truth is the cornerstone of society. And if you can't come to truth by listening to people, then, I mean, society just doesn't work like it should. Like, there's no functionality there. And everyone gets into this cloud of ignorance of ignoring each other and never actually knowing what's true. I can't help but shake the feeling that part of it has to do with the way people grow up and the experiences that they have growing up. I think that's where the key part of offense comes from, when people take offense in something. I think it has something to do with the way that they grew up and the circumstances that they grew up in.
Okay.
Which is, I can see, is an understandable way of getting offended, but I feel like, I'd think, not feel, first, that you can't speak honestly and say something about something important without offending someone. Like, the truth is inherently offensive to somebody, because oftentimes the truth hurts. And I think college campuses are a place for doing that, when and setting your ideas at least somewhat straight for the rest of your life, so you have direction and you have somewhere to go. But I think the aimlessness that colleges now have, and the students at colleges now have, where they can't form these sorts of ideas and certainly can't strengthen these forms of ideas, it's leading people down the wrong road in the incorrect path. And societies can't stand on a solid foundation that way.
That idea of truth as a cornerstone is very interesting. That's that's certainly a controversial claim. The idea of, I think part of one of the reasons I love debate is that really through debate, we eventually get better at figuring out what is actually true through the process of researching both sides. And typically I find that students will often reach the conclusion that neither of these sides is completely correct. And there's some reasonability to both sides of a debate issue. But sometimes the opposite happens, and students research an issue and they really conclude, oh, there is a right and a wrong answer here. And they're very much more prepared to explain why that is, rather than just adopting a cheer or a slogan to support their side.
Truth is the cornerstone of society is actually a Jordan Peterson idea. And he relates it to Western culture in the way that he says Western culture is predicated on the logos, and the logos encompassing everything as far as speech and truth goes. And he gives a small talk at this one place when he's on his book tour, saying that it's not safe to speak, but it's even more unsafe not to speak. And ooh, he's kind of plays along with those long-term consequences of, as he would call it, quote, being a bloody serf instead of standing up for yourself like a respectable human being.
Oh, that's a nice contrast. It's a good rhetorical device. You know, I think part of what he's getting at there, I suspect, is the tyranny of the unanswered argument. And we know this in debate as far as the way dropped arguments work, and how if you drop an argument, if you have a judge who is skilled at flowing, he's going to assume that that argument stands all the way through because it's not been opposed. Oddly enough, the same thing happens in society, where a social narrative becomes trumpeted, and really in the absence of any strong rebuttal to that social narrative, really the tyranny of the loudest newscaster or the tyranny of the loudest crowd in a venue, that really takes over.
Yeah, and I don't really understand why it feels like people are identifying more with their ideology than they are themselves. I feel like the value of the individual is starting to crumble in this case, because you see all of these controversial issues popping up. And I think that if you ask someone like, who are you, then I could almost expect to hear an answer like, I'm Republican or I'm Democrat, and not I'm, you know, Ethan or something, or and identifying it as an individual. Like, people are really stuck on one side of the political spectrum. I think that it's because, or at least partly, because people want to be a part of something bigger than themselves. So they would identify with an entire party or an entire ideology. But when you identify as such a large group rather than an individual, it cuts off so many streams of intellect and knowledge that you would otherwise have access to, or at least potential access to, that would be really valuable to an individual. But if you identify with an ideology, you have to inherently cut all of the other ones off if it's part of your identity, because once that identity is shaken, then you're unstable if your entire identity lies within one certain idea.
So that ideology seems like it has a bit of a pride or hubris at its base, where you assume this ideology has the totality of truth. So I need to shut down everything that's outside of this ideology.
Yeah, because otherwise you're unsafe, because you've identified fully with something like that. And people don't want to feel unsafe. They want to feel correct, even if it's not true.
Well, I think you may have just articulated a really interesting explanation of why safe spaces have been a thing, and hopefully will cease to be a thing. But we've been going on different tangents. Let's get to our article.
Let's do it.
And I need to grab my power cord, because this is all draining my battery faster than I expected. So while I do that, Ethan, could you describe the article? Just kind of summarize it for our listeners.
Right. Okay. So what's the res, listeners? We recently read this article about how ideas should be debated instead of denounced. And I think it's a really interesting idea, because there's two writers in the latter half of the article that talk about two completely different examples on different sides of the spectrum. And the main idea that they tag on is that ideas should be debated instead of denounced. And it starts to go into this narrative almost about how humans have been pushing away ideas rather than engaging with them on more of a regular basis than not, and how this is actually leading to the weakening of certain arguments that have the potential to be strengthened. And it's kind of going into a field of overall ignorance that, that the world could otherwise be safer from. And the article will go on into a few examples here, but the main idea remains that people are less open to ideas than they used to be, and this could be a dangerous thing when it comes to discovering truth.
Excellent. That's a really helpful summary. So our authors of that particular portion are Ian Kingsbury and Robert Maranto. Now, does it make a difference, do you think, that one of them is kind of a young scholar who's just finishing grad school, and the other is a tenured professor with 30 years of experience who's published 14 books and really is at the top of the game academically? Does their different experience what does that bring to this article?
I think this young scholar is very lucky because they've realized that they don't want to trap themselves in identity politics at such a young age, and that they have the ability to be open-minded enough to seek the truth, or at least I would hope so from what I can tell from the article. So one, that young person's very lucky. Two, it shows that truth is infused in society and saturates society wherever you go. Like, I mean, there's young people and old people both focused on not winning an argument or securing their own political identity, but discovering what's true is that's the most important value, and that's a value that anybody of any age can hold as long as... And if you truly look at the facts and have a logical debate without the biases of protecting a security that you have about your ideological identity, I think you'll find that you come closer to wanting to discover truth anyways. It's almost like a natural inclination. Humans were built to learn, and we're almost like machines that are built to learn, but we have consciences and all of these other things that get thrown into that complexity mix there. But finding truth is, we're good at it. I mean, we're rational animals, as Aristotle would put it, and letting that inclination run wild is not an unhealthy thing. It's a healthy thing that helps strengthen ideas and throw out the weak ones so that eventually you can chip away at the block and come to the center, which would be truth.
Well, and I think, and those are all helpful observations. I think in addition to that, I'd look at the fact that this shows kind of the pervasive nature of the problem that they're going to illustrate with two examples we need to talk through in just a moment. But being able to kind of show that a new scholar can see this as an issue coming into the academic field, and that an older scholar can say, oh yeah, this is true, it testifies to the validity of what they're saying. That they can kind of see it from both ends of the age spectrum, in a way. So it points to the universality of the problem, and it strengthens the fact that they're writing this both from these two angles definitely supports the validity of their argument.
One thing that concerns me that, again, Jordan Peterson talks about a lot, and he's just one of my favorite speakers, and he's a clinical psychologist at the University of Toronto. If you haven't read his book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, I highly recommend that you do. It was an international bestseller, number one on the top charts.
There it is. A good amount of time. Waiting on the plug.
Yeah, so I'll just throw his book out there really quick. But one thing that he talks about is how the education industry and field, especially college campuses, is saturated with postmodern theory or postmodernists. And these people, in a nutshell, are concerned with destroying all other ideas and building none to stand in their place. So it's an ideology that aims to destroy everything and build nothing, which almost leads to a sense of nihilism there, because you can destroy everything and then there's nothing left. Like, where's the meaning in life at all? You know what I mean? And there's absolutely nothing to go off of. And the funny thing is that the people who identify as postmodern, or at least have the postmodern type ideas, the destructive nature of wanting to destroy all other ideas, are very closed off to any sort of finding truth. And you can very easily tell when someone's goal is to discover truth or defend a political stance versus when their goal is to destroy your political stance. It's very clearly evident, and it's also very difficult to have conversations with those types of people.
Well, let's get into two examples that our article discusses that I think really kind of fit what you're describing. So the first example that they look at is has to do with Charles Murray and his book, The Bell Curve. Are you familiar with the controversy surrounding the bell curve, Ethan?
I got the essence of it, but I feel like you would do a better job explaining it to the listeners than I would.
Well, the Charles Murray is a very controversial fellow. He and a fellow author back in the 1990s, they wrote a book called The Bell Curve, where they set up a variety of empirical studies to reach troubling conclusions. Their conclusions fit this whole idea that that intelligence is genetically inherited, and that different races, white, black, Hispanic, Asian, and so on, different races are have a propensity towards being more or less intelligent. Now, I've not read The Bell Curve. I'm repeating that from multiple summaries. And Charles Murray came across my radar a couple years ago when he came to speak at Middlebury College, and the liberal arts college that had invited him promptly threw the students through a riot, such that he was physically in danger and he left the campus. He tried to record his session and his interview from his hotel room, but the riot moved from the campus to his hotel. And he eventually was fine, but that kind of put him on this national level of attention, at least that I became aware of him. I think he had a bit of fame when his book first came out. But the effect of this book, I mean, he's really been blackballed from the academy. I mean, in the sense that no one really investigates his claims. They just immediately label him with this term racist. Now, with that summary in mind, Ethan, why do the authors bring up Charles Murray and his book? Where does that come into this article?
Well, for one, the main idea is that people are not willing to hear out someone's ideas and they would throw them out instead. And the scary thing about that is that racism is almost like a canned argument. I mean, if someone's racist, you don't have to argue with them because their ideas are inherently false. And not in any way am I saying his ideas are correct. I'm saying that his ideas could be so easily disproven that it's almost mindless to throw him off of the campus and not directly clash with the ideas that he has and prove him wrong once and for all, or at least put a permanent stain on his ideological reputation that way. I think it would have been a really good, or at least for the students even, because inherited intelligence, there's so many different angles that you could study that from, or so many different studies you could pull from that show that this obviously is not true, which I think the article later goes into of how his works were eventually disproven. But this took way longer than it should have. I mean, colleges have the evidence that they need. The studies have been done. If you allocate those correctly and put them against his theory, then the data shows that his ideas aren't true. But the problem that the article addresses is that the universities would rather throw this guy out than prove his ideas wrong and label him with racist, because it's a lot faster and it justifies that he's an oppressive person and his ideas shouldn't be heard. So the ideas still stand as long as they're not refuted by any empirical evidence, but the person is thrown out.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because that fits several of the fallacies of diversion that we talked about in logic class earlier this year, where you focus on the person rather than focusing on the argument that he's made. I thought it was just absolutely fascinating the way the authors describe the different pedagogical approaches to using Charles Murray. And they describe how most people will simply reject Murray, and they will they'll try to look at they'll slam him in their courses, but they won't ever assign it. So one of these two, and the authors are careful. They don't actually say which of them did this. But one of these authors assigned the book The Bell Curve in one of the seminar courses and required students to read it. And lo and behold, they had the same thing happen that I've seen happen time and time again in a high school setting. When you hand students a terrible argument and then ask them to discuss it, you don't have to. If the students are well trained and if they have the basics of logic and intellectual inclinations, they can identify why the argument is bad. You don't have to just tell them it's bad and cloak it with this aura of the forbidden, horrible argument. Instead, no, pull that aura back. Look at the argument itself and let the students realize how flawed it is. Now, that being said, I've not done the reading. I don't have the credentials to really critique Charles Murray's argument. I assume that it's kind of flawed. I think intelligence is really a very complicated thing. I don't really know how you measure it. So I don't know how you would attach it to genetic inheritance. That being said, I think they demonstrate the fact that if you really just hand this to people and trust people who are already educated to the extent that they're in college and are interested enough in the subject that they've taken a course on the subject, and then trust them to analyze it and figure out if the argument is sound or not, then they debunk it themselves, which is going to be much stronger than simply shouting with the microphone, "This argument is bad!"
Right, because in that case, you're at a university, a place that's a center for learning, provided with a golden opportunity to refute an argument that an invalid argument and at least have practice in that way or defend a belief of your own. But the education aspect goes away and it's almost like you're not being educated, you're being indoctrinated because this person's labeled as a racist, next question. And then eventually you go and find, 10 other people with similar ideas and label them all with racist. And eventually you'll get to a point where you can't label people as racist and be correct about it. And the ideas will be there and you have to engage directly with the ideas and you won't have the practice or the skills to be ready to do that in the real world, or at least outside of university when it really matters. And then your ideas don't seem as valid as they would have if you did acquire that skill earlier on.
Well, and one other fallout from that is that wider society sees a couple of those examples that are valid and says, oh, this accusation of racism is an important thing. And once somebody's labeled racist, we're not going to listen to their ideas as much. Well, then, I don't know if you're familiar with the group, it's the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center. They've hit several headlines in recent months, but they've really taken this to a whole new level where they've accumulated a certain bit of legitimacy they build themselves as a think tank and a legal center. But in reality, their big thing is to accuse other groups of being racist and to call for people to stop funding any group that they label racist. And they've started applying that label to really anyone that disagrees with their views as an institution. So suddenly this label of racist is thrown around to such an extent that it really spreads far beyond, as you said a minute ago, far beyond where it's legitimate. And that's a dangerous place for a culture to be in.
I think that just a quick note for our listeners here, that there's two sides of the spectrum here. There's saying that racism exists, which is what the universities are doing by throwing out these people and not letting them speak there. But there's also the side of the coin that says racism is wrong. I won't deny that racism exists. I know it exists, and I certainly know that it's there. But it's almost like you're giving more respect to the severity of racism and how bad racism is by proving it wrong than just labeling someone who is racist and saying that it's there. So it's giving more respect to how terrible racism is to actually hear it out and wipe it out in at least one scenario. You can't wipe out all of racism, but if you have a golden opportunity to prove racism wrong somewhere and you throw that opportunity out, then what good are you doing the world? There's just false bias, ideologies out there that could have been perfectly refuted and with good evidence as well that would compel any logical person to agree with you. And you've given up a golden opportunity to eliminate some illogical racism in the world just by labeling it as racism and identifying it as there. There's no second move there. It's just there.
That's a fascinating thought. I had not thought about that before. That's really interesting. So that really by using these labels, you're rejecting the opportunity to engage in debate and affect real change by persuading other people rather than just getting everyone on a bandwagon to shout together.
Yeah, and it's just to kind of pick your brain for a second, just really quickly, because there's another belief that goes along with this. I feel like, or I think that before people were more open to the truth, or in a way where you would want to implement the truth. Like the ideal situation is to implement truth. Now we see people being closed off to many ideas. And if truth is discovered by someone who doesn't want to accept it in modern society, people are much more prone to not accept the truth, regardless of whether it's true or not, because people want to feel safe. At least that's my theory. So is it still important to tell the truth or to spend energy and time coming to truthful conclusions if people will not implement the truth any longer, but even if they know that they're wrong? So where's the value in discussing things for the purpose of finding truth if the cultural movement is towards feeling safe over implementing truth for the progression of, and betterment of society?
Well, so that's a huge question for starters. That's a really fun question. So I think in part, we need to make several distinctions here to even start approaching this question. But at first, we should note that truth is never really popular. The people throughout human history who have seen something that is true, and even the sort of truth that is recognized by later generations. I'm no Buddhist, but I can certainly recognize that the Buddha understood something that was true about human suffering, and so on.
That life is suffering.
Yeah, that suffering is something we have to deal with. I'm not a Hindu either, but I can recognize there's a logic, there's a truth of a sort to the Hindu system of karma. I think it falls apart if you press it too far, but there's something true that's seen there. Well, but the people who see such things, they're never terribly popular, especially in their own lifetime, because truth always carries with it this burden that you have to live, you have to live according to it. So truth is not just something that you can academically assume and like, okay, I see that. Once you actually see that, it demands that you live in accordance with it.
If I'm sitting here thinking about things that are true, and so to use the life as suffering example, well, if I don't take any responsibility for anything and I ignore that fact, I don't have to deal with the suffering that, like, people can just go on and gratify, you know, their immediate desires. And if, as long as you don't adopt any responsibility, I mean, it's quite a nihilistic viewpoint, but then what's the point, and where's the honor, and where's the strength, and where's the societal foundation of accepting truth when, if you ignore it and don't accept any responsibility, then your life would quote unquote be so much better, I guess you could say. I don't agree with that idea, but I definitely want to hear what you think to that.
Well, I mean, I think at that point, based on what we've already established, that if we assume truth exists and that we as human beings are creatures who are drawn to truth and that we perceive truth, but then let's say as you're suggesting, we still ignore that truth. Well, at that point, we become, if we perceive truth and we ignore it because the lie is more pleasurable, or something like that, or the lie is the truth demands that I love my neighbor and I actually care for my neighbor, but I'd much rather serve myself and make myself happy rather than helping someone else. Well, at that point, I've become complicit in causing the world to go in a negative direction. I'm complicit in the very suffering, as to go with your life as suffering example. I'm now complicit in the selfishness, and I'm morally guilty of not adhering to truth. Now, that, of course, is always assuming that truth exists, it is objective in some way, and that it is part of our duty as rational beings in a logocentric world to learn to perceive truth and then to live in accordance with it. So, all of this is getting us quite afield, but it's a good place to be, and it sounds like you've definitely been reading Jordan Peterson this week.
I have been reading Jordan Peterson this week.
Yeah, that's good. That's he's a great thing. He's a good thinker to drive us to these questions. Yeah. Now, let's go back to our article though, because there's one last piece that really our article gets at. So, Ethan, talk to us about Ilhan Omar and where she comes in at the tail end of this article. What's going on with Representative Omar?
See, I read this one, and one, in this example, the resistance to any sort of new ideas was a lot more evident to me. Like, the last one was a really clear-cut example, like the bell curve, and that one went by rather quickly, and you could see the biases really fast. This one, I could sort of see it, but I was a little bit more confused as to digging deeper and understanding where exactly this resistance is coming from. So I'm not really sure about this one.
Yeah, it's tricky, and I think I as I read through it this morning, second or third time, I was like, I don't think in terms of the writing and in terms of the clarity of their own examples, I think our authors start to trail off here in terms of their own their responsibility as authors in terms of the clarity at the conclusion of their piece.
Yeah,
but they're looking at a fascinating figure. Representative Ilhan Omar is the first Muslim congresswoman to be elected in the United States. And she is one of, I saw another article last week that was lumped her in with someone else as the mean girls of Congress. She's in there with a couple others who have been very outspoken in some of their personal views. And the article I was looking at in particular was, it was arguing that this is an effect of the age of Trump. If we can even say that phrase seriously.
The age of Trump.
In the middle of his first, still inside his first presidency. I think it's ridiculous to label things too early, but be that as it may. We have a president who uses extreme rhetoric, and this article was arguing Ilhan Omar and others have begun responding with equally extreme rhetoric. And this article is picking up on I thought the examples were fascinating, that she has used strongly anti-Semitic language. She is a Muslim, and ethnically she is from, I don't know if this article kind of got into it. I want to say Pakistan, but I am not confident about that. So there's a quote that this article gives from 2012 where Representative Omar said, quote, "Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel." Continuing in that paragraph, "In recent months, as a member of Congress, Omar charged that Jewish money bought support for Israel and that American Jews held allegiance to Israel rather than the United States." And she goes on to make several additional claims. Now, what we're dealing with here is a fascinating reality, first and foremost, that we now have an American congresswoman who is radically opposed to Israel, which is a different perspective than the majority of American views have held over the last century, particularly since the founding of Israel, political Israel in 1948. Is that right? I think it's 1948. It's the 1940s. 1940, I think it's 1947. Be that as it may, Israel is widely hated by the Arab community, and Representative Omar fits in that community. Where this comes into our article is that Omar has not been censored for her remarks. There's a certain decorum that's expected of members of the United States government, and if another person, particularly on the Republican side of the House, had made such comments, it would not be, I don't think it would surprise anybody if big heavy hitters on the Democratic side, folks like Elizabeth Warren, folks like Bernie Sanders, immediately trotted out some time-honored arguments about how these remarks are disrespectful to the human person, these remarks are not befitting an elected official of the United States of America, and so on. These are not appropriate remarks. Not to deny that person free speech, but rather simply to say, this is not okay. You can't go around hurling accusations about how awful Jews are and how the Jewish conspiracy has taken over the world and expect people to take you seriously. But that hasn't happened. What this article goes on to conclude by the end is that instead, the congressional Democrats have really drawn around her and protected her. And there's not been the adequate debate about this Jewish conspiracy. So by the end of the article, our authors suggest that, you know what? It's fine. Have Omar Ilhan on one side, have somebody who is a staunch defender of Israel on the other side, and let them have the debate about the effect of Jewish culture in the United States of America. And I think this part this is where I wish our authors had done a better job kind of saying this at the end, but they left me with this sense that their conviction is that when you have a fair, open, and honest debate, the truth will win out. So if it is true that Jews have in fact been conspirators and are really the secret force behind American history, which is ridiculous, then that will win out. If it's true that, in fact, the Jewish community in America is one of many communities and America has a longstanding tie to support Israel, that's important for our geopolitical stance in the Middle East and for our religious heritage as a country, then that too will win out. But that the refusal to even have the debate is a massive change for the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
If we were to jump back to the era of the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, you would have the political spectrum looked wildly different. The folks who are on the left-leaning side of the political spectrum had a bedrock conviction for freedom of speech and open discussion. This was true congressionally, it was true in academia. And when we jump to the 21st century, that bedrock commitment to freedom of speech and public discussion and public debate to inform the voting public who then have to make a decision, that conviction has eroded, particularly on the left. It may have eroded just as much on the right, but I don't think it has. I think it's much more a problem of the left because the left has rejected the idea of objective truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been talking for a while. What do you think of all that?
So I think there's a heavy distinction between the right, liberal, and left. Because so there's almost like there's three sides of a spectrum here where in the left, I would agree, like the radical left is the postmodern force that rejects all ideas and specifically objective truth. I think that one, I believe that liberals are correct about some things. Two, I believe conservatives are correct about some things. And debate is an absolutely necessary dialogue to determine who's correct about what. And that's why you bring in evidence and statistics to bolster your arguments and values, especially because without a value, you really can't come to any conclusions if you don't value anything that your facts are behind. And you debate about it. I'm honestly, like, this is a very, I love this topic. And it's utterly disappointing to me how closed off to the truth people are. Like, how are you going to live on a lie? Or how are you going to live being okay with living on a lie? Do you not want to know what reality is? Do you not want society to function to the utmost capability or potential that it could? It really appalls me how people on either side of the spectrum, which on the radical left, I see it everywhere, but it's speckled out throughout any political stance or orientation, that how closed off people are. Like, truth is not meant to, objective truth is not built to offend you. Objective truth is built to let you stand on it and live in coincidence with reality so that you can have a functioning society and maybe make something of yourself and reduce the suffering that exists in the world. Like, if you don't stand on a podium of truth or on a bedrock of truth, then one, you're living at least a relative lie. And I think, well, I mean, nobody knows the truth about everything. So that's why you have to work to go find it. Sometimes it's not an easy thing to find. I mean, sometimes it's as simple as just looking, like, I have a coffee mug next to the table, like right here. If I trust my senses and I'm not a crazy person in some sort of matrix simulation, there's a coffee mug on the table. That's great. That's an objective truth. Some things are not so easy to figure out, and that's where politics comes in. But, like, I hope that someone in Congress is listening to this right now, and someone who's closed off and really, really wants to limit freedom of speech, because limiting freedom of speech is really nice when it's your opponent that can't speak, because then all you can do is speak.
That's a great line.
Yeah, it's really nice when your opponent can't speak, because then you could just talk the whole time and you hear one side of the argument. And if that person is well articulated and knows how to think and knows how to talk, regardless of their correct or incorrect, it's going to sound like they're right because there's nothing opposing to it. And that's why especially the people on the radical left want to limit people on the liberal side and the conservative side, is, and which they have with safe spaces and all these things and throwing people off of campuses, because then all of a sudden they sound appealing when what they're doing is just destroying all ideas, creating a sense of nihilism where nothing in the world matters. Like, why would I follow truth? Well, you would follow truth to live in coincidence with reality, reduce some of your suffering, like, you know, stand up straight with your shoulders back, as Peterson would put it in Rule 1 of his book, and bear some responsibility in an honorable way and reduce the suffering of life and, quote, be a light on the world instead of a blight.
Now, as you were saying that, I'm keeping an eye on our time. We are running, we're probably about towards the conclusion of this episode.
Okay.
I thought three things I thought of that I'm gonna offer as my closing thoughts, and I'll toss it back your way. First, I think to bring this back to where we started this episode with the Green New Deal. I think the Green New Deal started as an attempt to simply shout about the immediate urgency of climate change. But it's really interesting that when it's actually brought to the point of a debate and a discussion, the people that you would expect to say, oh, of course, I will stand up and actually defend this thing, were not willing to do so. They weren't willing to stand and debate for their cause. But secondly, there's something about human beings. We are these rational creatures. We do have this urge towards truth, and we recognize truth when we see it, which I think is why debate and public discussion are so important. When it's shut down, we really remove the ability of people to hear the other side. One of my favorite lines in the Old Testament book of Proverbs says, "The first one to present his case sounds right until the second guy comes along." Yeah. That's a little bit of a modern paraphrase, but that's the gist of it. The last thing, as you were saying, reminded me of, I know we've talked about this in logic quite a bit, but if we have a patron saint of debate, it might be Socrates, I think. And right. Socrates, of course, insisted that everyone else was wrong. He didn't know what was right, but he did know that they were wrong, and he eventually persuaded them to that point, so much so that they killed him for his gift of truth. So right. I think it's important for us to at least acknowledge, as we're discussing these things, that this is never going to be the mainstream point of view. This is never going to be the thing that everyone adheres to. If truth was the mainstream thing that people actually acted upon in mass, vape would never be a best-selling substance in the United States.
This world would be such a more solid place.
It would be.
If truth were prevalent in society.
It would be. But it is this world, and maybe we can go with, we're looking more for slow change, one person at a time, maybe as we, and it really points us right back to how really each debate is an opportunity to attempt to persuade. And as we listen and as we dialogue, we are moving closer towards the truth through the conflict of ideas. So yeah. That's really all I've got. Any last thoughts on this one as we wrap up the episode?
It's never going to be practical for a politician to tell the truth all the time, because they're not going to get reelected. Because quite evidently, if you're, a conservative congressperson, maybe the liberals are correct about something that someone on the conservative side who's closed off to all the, a voter, especially on the conservative side, that's closed off to all of these ideas, and this could be true for the flip side of the coin as well, will not support their congressperson in a decision that has these liberal undertones. And same for a liberal towards the conservative side. But sometimes it's not a polarized opinion that's correct. There can, in some cases, be a mix of the two. Mm-hmm. And the more radical cases, like maybe abortion and stuff, you can't have abortion and not abortion at the same time. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying more of like a local policy issue, maybe, or, mm-hmm. or some kind of thing like that.
Politics gets messy. It's very rarely so white and black.
I wish a politician would come out and say, first of all, there's an incentive to get reelected, so that takes away from truth in and of itself, because it's going to make your reelection very unlikely if you tell the truth all the time because of the way people are oriented and the beliefs that they hold. But I would say to any sort of politician, any sort of person out there, tell the truth, or as Jordan Peterson would say, or at least don't lie. And I guess that's a really good start. Learn to tell the truth, because you may not get reelected, but the truth will always win out. Why? Because the truth is real. And once you put yourself in reality, you can hide yourself from the truth all you want. You can put yourself in a mindset and a state of nihilism, ignoring responsibility. Something will get you eventually. The truth is real. That might even play off the idea of karma that you were talking about earlier, like that the small truth or the essential truth I might have there. Just truth is truly the cornerstone of society, and it matches with reality. And I'm disappointed by the fact that people aren't willing to tell the truth, and especially politicians aren't willing to tell the truth for the incentive of getting reelected. If you really want to make the world a better place, learn to tell the truth, and people will realize that what you're saying is real, what you're saying is accurate, and you may never learn that they actually see you that way or see your words that way, because people won't be willing to accept the truth, but it will be there, and regardless of whether people want to accept it or not, and reality will coincide with what you say. And it's important to tell the truth, because it's the only foundation that you can stand on and be safe standing on in a world of suffering that we live in.
All right. Well, this has been a bonus episode of What's the Res, focusing on Maureen Downey's article in the Atlantic Journal Constitution. We'll put the link to that article in the show notes. That article is entitled "Rather Than Denounce Controversial Ideas and Speakers on Campus, Debate Them." Thank you for joining us today on a spring break episode of What's the Res. Ethan, if any of our listeners want to get in contact with us, send us hate mail, and tell us all about why we're terrible people for standing up for objective truth, how could they get in contact with us?
If you would like to tell us how terrible we are for standing up for objective truth, please do follow us on Instagram at whatstheres_, or email us at whatstheres@gmail.com. That's whatstheres@gmail.com, and we'd be happy to receive all hate mail or all non-hate mail, and respond to those accordingly.
Thank you. Excellent. All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us today on What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. Join us next time for more What's the Res.